Had to get my guest on the phone. This is Alan. I am not Mark Hurst. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to fill in tonight, Mark. Thank you. And so we have on the phone, I hope we didn't lose him, Tim O'Hara. Oh, Madonna me. Un momento, por favor. Co-founder and core team member of Rancho Mazatel, an education center, working farm, Eagle Lodge, and community rooted in environmental sustainability that offers apprenticeships, residential workshops, and guest experiences. There's a lot to say about this place, but I'm going to allow Timo to do it. I'm going to get him on the phone now. If not, it's going to be me talking about it a lot. Timo, are you there? I am a professional. That's why you're there. We did this. We are connected. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing great. I am going to put on the sounds of Rancho Mazatel, Starboard Quirk, in the morning as we have this conversation. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Can you hear it?
I can hear it, yes.
Nice. What's that bird?
Oh, goodness. not my forte, Al. You know that.
Yeah, me neither. That's why I asked you. So why don't we just start with a general overview of Rancho Mazatel. The reason I thought this would be an interesting show, Mark's show very effectively and necessarily talks about the pitfalls and the dark cloud hovering over us that is modern-day digital technology and a lot of the social media aspects that accompany it. And so I thought maybe we could talk to somebody or a group of folks who are using stepping back in time or reinventing old world technologies or using different kinds of technologies more effectively. So why don't you give a little overview of the ranch and what we do there?
Okay. I'll try to do a good job of summing it up. Briefly, I thought your introduction was appropriate and concise and did a good job at explaining what it is more or less that we do, but I can add to that a little bit. Essentially, we're a sustainability education center. It's a pretty diverse project. We are a working farm, an education center, and a community, as was mentioned. We offer a wide variety of workshops on a whole host of different topics, all related to sustainability, the environment, permaculture, for those of you that might have heard that term. So those topics include natural building, agroforestry, fermentation, food processing, wilderness medicine, medicinal plants, and a whole host of other topics that kind of fall under the sustainability umbrella. We also offer custom design educational programming to high school students, gap year programs, college, university students, and just guests who come through our facility who are interested in sustainability and thinking about how we might be able to live a little bit differently on this planet today to have less of a negative environmental, social, financial impact. We live in a small rural community, only about 110 people. We're on the edge of a rainforest. We have a conservation component to our project. Most of our property is set aside as a private wildlife refuge, so most of the 300 acres that makes up the education is mostly rainforest that's been set aside for habitat and its environmental services, and then we manage 15 acres in food production and built infrastructure. We are very community-focused, and we are a community. We have six core team members that live on site in Mastatal at all times. We have a year-long apprenticeship, so we invite between five and seven apprentices who apply to our year-long apprenticeship, people who are interested in the type of work that we're doing and want to immerse themselves 100% in that lifestyle and learn about a lot of the topics that I talked about and more. We have a two-year internship, and then, you know, we just get a lot of guests, families, individuals who are interested in visiting a rural community on the edge of a beautiful rainforest with access to clean water, clean rivers, and looking to get off the beaten path a little bit in Costa Rica.
Fantastico. So I want to sort of unpack a lot of what you just said. Maybe we'll go down the list of a lot of the things that you talked about. And eventually what I'd like to do is take a little walk through town. Maybe you could take us a walk through the village of Mastatal, but we're going to get to that later. And one of the other things I'm going to want to talk about is how you got involved in this and why. And I also want to let the listeners know that probably around maybe 6:40, we're going to open up the phone to calls. And if you have any questions for Timo, you can call in at 201-209-9368. But let's have a nice chat first, and then we'll, about 20 minutes before our show's over, we'll take some phone calls. So there's a link on your website that ties nicely to Tectonic. It's called Appropriate Technologies. And I don't want to, like, hyper-focus on trying to make this a show about technology because it's Tectonic, but I do kind of want to make that tie in a little bit. So why don't you say a little bit about what you mean and what you're trying to do with, quote-unquote, appropriate technology?
Yeah, so appropriate technology, you know, briefly, are just technologies that we're trying to implement at the ranch that fit into our particular context. And so generally these technologies are low impact on the environment. They're efficient. They're able to be maintained in-house or in the community. They're generally supporting somebody in the community, a group, or individuals in the community in some way, shape, or form. They are locally accessible, locally available, oftentimes originating from the community or from the region. And these technologies are what we feel, you know, are appropriate for our particular setting. So I could give you a few examples just to make this a little bit clearer for the listeners, perhaps. And one of my favorites personally is the biodigester that we have at the ranch, at the main house where we take all of our meals and have three bathroom facilities. All of the human waste that is sent to the biodigester as opposed to a sewage treatment plant or a septic system essentially goes into this contraption, this tool that's called a biodigester, and so all the human waste goes in to essentially this tank that is populated by anaerobic bacteria, and that human waste is broken down by those anaerobic bacteria, and the anaerobic decomposition of the human waste produces methane, which is one of the byproducts, and that methane we're able to capture under a fiberglass dome and essentially pipe that into our kitchen to use it as one of our cooking technologies. Methane is a combustible gas, and so we're able to bring that right up into the kitchen. It's a very simple, passive system. We can fix it if something goes wrong. We are able to source the fuel for that humanure or human waste, as it's sometimes called, even though I don't like the term waste because, you know, obviously it's something that can be used productively. All animals, of course, defecate, and why we call ours waste and no other animal's waste is something that I think we need to educate people about perhaps a little bit more. We're also able to source local cow manure, which also helps to power the biodigester. So that's one example. Composting toilets, I guess, while we're on the topic of dealing with human feces, human waste, the other way that we deal with our human waste is through the use of dry toilets or composting toilets. We have about 12 of these composting toilets throughout our campus where people are able to use the bathroom. The human waste decomposes on site. In this case, it's an aerobic decomposition. We add sawdust to the human waste and let it decompose naturally with the help of aerobic bacteria, and that allows us to get essentially a finished product, a finished fertilizer that we're able to harvest after about 6 months with the high microbial activity in the tropics, and we're able to use that on the agroforestry species in our orchards to help fertilize and keep fertility high in the food production spaces around the ranch.
I want to just say a little something about the process of getting that biodigester up and running effectively on a regular basis. I've spent, I think, combined in all the years that I've been going to the ranch, which I think I started around 2004, I think I've spent about between four and five years total at Rancho Mazatitl. And one of the things that Timo and I have done a lot together is driving a little pickup truck up the road to a farmer named Chilo's house, where he has a bunch of cows, and then he harvests. Hey, there's a truck coming down the road right now. Timo, you hear it? Hear that? Who do you think that might be?
Don't know.
Yeah. But so in Chilo, we pick up these rice sacks full of. That truck's coming down from Zapatone, by the way. Hear it?
What, Jack?
The truck in their back. You don't hear it?
No, I can't hear that. It's a little too low for me. Sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll get it up a little bit. And we would pick up maybe 10 to 12 rice sacks full of cow manure, and we'd pull that little pickup truck on the side of a muddy embankment, and 1 foot on the embankment, 1 foot on the pickup truck, picking up these, about 50 pounds of cow poop each. And
yep.
Never once do you leave there unscathed without getting a lot of mucky cow poop all over your legs and knees. To make its way down to the biodigester. And I love every minute of it every time we do it.
It's a pretty magical process for sure.
Yeah. So maybe we'll go through some of the technologies that you talked about or just the processes. And as we do so, I'm going to post a link to the playlist and comments board of workshops that are offered at the ranch, encompassing these processes. So building with earth, why don't you talk a little bit about that, what it means and what you do?
Yeah, one of our focuses and strengths is natural building. We build a lot with earth where we are in Costa Rica and part of the country where we are, and actually throughout much of the country there are high quantities of clay in the soil, and so that allows us to use this clay-rich soil to build with. And so we essentially harvest the earth from the building sites. It's all over the place, and we're able to mix it with different proportions of sand and fiber, straw, or other fibers, and essentially make a material that you're able to build with. And still, in the world, more people live in earthen houses than any other type of construction, so this is certainly not anything that we invented. This is something that's been around for thousands of years. People have lived in earthen homes for millennia. A lot of the earthen construction in Costa Rica has more or less been pushed to the side or even forgotten about, even though there's a long history of living in earthen houses, based on the fact that cement really has become the most used and ubiquitous building resource now. And if you know anything about cement, you'll know that its impact on the environment is extremely high. 7 or 8 or even 9% of greenhouse gases are emitted just from the production of Portland cement worldwide. And so we are trying to do our part to use the earth right under our feet to be able to build with, and not only that, but teach other people who might be interested in lower impact styles of building how to do this. So I'm sure most listeners are familiar with the term adobe. That's an earth building technique that was popularized in the southwestern part of the U.S. There's still a lot of buildings that are built out of adobe, and so it's an earthen building technique that we use, as well as wattle and daub, rammed earth, cob. There are a whole host of different earth building techniques, and so for the last 23 years, we've been building out our campus essentially using these earth building techniques to build the houses, the classrooms, the outbuildings that we use in our campus, and it's become, you know, a big focus of ours. Everybody, or at least almost everybody on this earth, has access to earth that has some clay in it that would be appropriate for building. And I would say, yeah, it's one of the most appropriate technologies that we use at the ranch. Our buildings are built out of a lot of earth, as well as other natural building materials that are local to us, such as wood and bamboo and stone. The buildings, I think a lot of people think of earthen buildings as being rustic or hobbit houses or not very nice to live in, but they can be exceedingly beautiful and perform very well, be very comfortable. For those of you that want to, you know, check out our site, you can see some pictures of the incredible structures that we're building. We're currently building a large dorm structure. The wall systems will all be out of wattle and daub, which is the most common earth building technique that we use, which is essentially a combination of bamboo, a latticework of bamboo that is then covered by a mixture of sand, straw, and clay. And then we are plastering those walls with either lime or an earthen plaster, and for most people that come through our facilities, they wouldn't even know that these buildings were built out of earth if we didn't tell them.
So you said 23 years ago is about when you started this?
Yeah, we'll turn 24 in November, so we opened our doors, it was November 1st, 2001, so if my math is correct, we'll have been there 23 years.
You want to say a little bit about how to introduce the audience to Robin a little bit, and how it came to be that you decided to make this life choice and make a career out of it?
Yeah, this is an endeavor that has included many more people than just myself, so this is a good opportunity to make sure that everybody understands that this has been a group effort. Thousands of hands have contributed to the building of our project, to the success of it. Robin is my wife and life partner. We have a 16-year-old daughter who also lives with us at the ranch and dabbles in these different technologies that we're touching on. We, in 2000, essentially decided to begin this journey of finding a more meaningful existence. We met in the Peace Corps in South America in 1994, and we were always open to the possibility of returning to Latin America at some point. We're both fluent Spanish speakers and interested and fascinated with the Latino culture, and I have a degree in agricultural economics, and my first job out of college was with Chiquita, Chiquita Brands International, large agribusiness, and that job, as well as another corporate job I had post Peace Corps, really were quite disheartening for me, and they motivated me to search for other alternatives out there, to feel like I was doing something a bit more fulfilling with my time and energy and resources. Robin and I were living in Seattle after the Peace Corps, and we started to look at other ways to make ends meet. I don't want to go in, I guess, to too many details, otherwise I'll take up the rest of the time, but make a long story short, we ended up visiting Costa Rica with some friends and being introduced to the property that currently houses Rancho Mastatal, and we started brainstorming and putting together some ideas as to what we might be able to do to make financial ends meet while pursuing this more fulfilling lifestyle. And we ended up coming up with this idea of a sustainability education center. As we were reskilling and trying to figure out what it was that we could do to make a living, we were looking for places such as the one that we created to be able to learn more about the topics that we've been talking about, and it felt like there was a real lack of these types of education centers around the U.S. and elsewhere, and so we essentially decided to build the place that we were looking for at that time, and that led us to this small rural community. Speaking of technology, and in this case, the lack thereof it, when we moved to Mastatal, you know, we had no phone coverage or no phones, and we lived for the first decade there essentially without access to phones, which was an interesting way to start a hospitality project that really necessitated being in communication with the people that wanted to come there to support us, which obviously resulted in some significant challenges for us early on.
Yeah, I'll just tell a brief story. So in 2004, so a few years after you started, generally most people, if they wanted access to a phone, had to walk up the hill. How many kilometers to San Miguel?
5K.
Five kilometers up a hill to a payphone where you had to have a calling card. It was outside of a really cool bar and in a little beautiful, another beautiful little local community. And then you would wait in line for other folks who were trying to access the phone. And that would be the way that I would call home or call a friend back home once a week. And then incrementally, communication technology inundated or just became more available. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later if we have time. But what I do want to talk about before we get back to other technologies and workshops is the town and the people. And so maybe a way to do it is sort of when you walk out the gates of Rancho Mastatal and you head through the town, maybe you could sort of describe what you see and who you'd see and what it's like.
Yeah. Yeah, well, what you see today is definitely quite different than what we saw in 2001 when we first got there. In many parts of the world, you know, rural communities continue to get depopulated for a wide variety of economic and social reasons, and that was certainly the situation in Mastatal in 2001. It was a community that was losing its best and its brightest by the droves. It really was a community that was disappearing off the map, dying, farms being sold or lost for one reason or another. And that's definitely what, you know, not what you see these days. So the ranch is interestingly located right between a national park, which became a national park after we got there in 2003. the large property that abuts the back side of our property, the north side of our property, became a national park, and then out our front gate is the small community of Mastatal, kind of downtown Mastatal. So out our back door is more or less untouched wilderness, providing habitat for flora and fauna of the area, and out our front gate is the community, is the intersection in town. If you go to the left out the gate, you reach an indigenous reserve called Zapaton. It's about 9 kilometers down that road, one of 24 indigenous reservations in Costa Rica. And if you stay to the right, you walk through downtown. So as it is today, it's populated by a number of small businesses that have been sprouting up little by little over the last couple of decades. You pass by Chepo and Lily's, or so Paso de las Lapas, which is a small restaurant that opened up around 2006 to essentially offer foodstuffs and other items to the population there, as well as the visitors that are coming through. A few more meters down the road, on the opposite side of the road, is one of the last kind of outdoor bars in Costa Rica. It's a fantastic place called Bar Seco, and a place that opened up to meet the needs of the community for those that enjoy adult beverages. Opened by a local family, our neighbors, a very vibrant outdoor bar that sees a lot of activity. Continuing down the main road on the right-hand side, we have a little playground area that then is adjacent to the local high school. It's a rural high school. There's about 30 students divided between the 5 grades. My daughter is a 10th grader there. Across the street is our community center, and then a little bit further down past the high school is the local Catholic church, and then that continues to a row of houses that are owned and lived in by some of the local folks there that have been there for generations. And eventually that brings you to, I think, the most important place in town, which is the local soccer field. It's one of the most lively places in the afternoon, usually populated by kids of all ages, adults, girls, boys, and really the place that gives teenagers and others the opportunity to get out and move their bodies. We play a lot of sports, ultimate frisbee, volleyball, soccer, of course, which was referred to as football. Beyond that is the local elementary school, and my daughter also went and graduated from a few years back. And then continuing down the road a little bit further, you'll come upon a wonderful business owned by two locals, Finca Siempre Verde. They offer guiding services, bird watching, hikes up to the peak in the national park. A little bit beyond that is La Iguana Chocolate, which is an outstanding sustainability project focused on chocolate production, one of the few places in the world that does tree-to-bar production. They harvest and ferment all of their own cacao and turn it into world-class chocolate. And then eventually you get to that town that Al talked about, which is San Miguel, the next town up that used to be home to the only public phone in the region. So that's what's happening up that way. In addition to that, there are a number of other small businesses that have appeared over the years, almost all of them being initiated by entrepreneurs in the community that have called Mastatal home for generations, which is really one of the magical characteristics of Mastatal, how it's kind of been able to, at least in my humble opinion, kind of turn around from this depopulating backwater to become this incredibly vibrant local economy that bases its economic activity on projects related to sustainability and the environment. And it's really been able to, yeah, create this character and this personality that has attracted people from all over the world who are interested in, yeah, seeing a small rural community do really well based on these ideals of taking care of one another, taking care of the environment, and buying in to the ideals of sustainability.
Lovely answer. Thank you, Timo. I just saw, so there's so many topics I want to cover, and we're more than halfway through the show. So the host of, I just saw through the security camera, the host of Bad Animals, one of the hosts of Bad Animals, Amanda, just walked in. And so I wanted to ask you about local wildlife. And so a few questions I want to answer ask before we get back to technology is about local wildlife. A day in the life of Rancho Mastatal, maybe when a group is there, maybe be the best way to think about that. And then we'll get back to the next thing, which will be permaculture design. So what kind of local wildlife are people going to see in Mastatal? And another thing I wanted to mention was Costa Rica is considered, it depends on tourism, a large part for its economy. But if you go to towns, mountain town like Monteverde or beach towns like Jaco or many, many, many beach towns, 10, 20, 30 buses a day come through town. Mastatal, comparatively speaking, is not a very touristed town. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. That's correct.
Yeah. So local wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody ever had like a coloring book growing up of the rainforest, and, you know, you pick out the animals in the coloring book and you color them the color that you want, you know, they're all kind of piled close to one another, which isn't the reality, but what animals you did see in that coloring book are the ones that, you know, we have in the rainforest surrounding Mastatal. So, you know, monkeys, of course, sloths, of course, anteaters. As far as the birders out there, Mastatal is becoming a birding destination. Birders and others who are into ornithology and birding activities have recorded over 400 species of birds in and around Mastatal. Of course, we've got quite a few reptiles, including quite a number of species of venomous snakes, which not everybody is happy to hear. We have pumas, which we've been seeing increasingly in our area, much to the chagrin of some of the cattle owners, but for those that love to see the increasing biodiversity there, it's been amazing to see those sightings going up. Ocelots, cauceles, or margays, and then, yeah, what else? I mean, some things that you would see here, such as raccoons. We've got, you know, poisonous dart frogs. As far as herpetologists go, it's a dreamland for those that are interested in amphibians and reptiles, white-tailed deer, mapaches, coatis. I could go on and on. It's quite a diverse place, both from a flora and fauna perspective. And, you know, I think the stats are something like, you know, Costa Rica's, it represents, you know, a very small percentage of the landmass in the world, but represents something like 7% of the diversity globally. So, yeah, it's an incredibly diverse landscape.
So we have about 25 minutes to go. In about 5 minutes, I'm going to open up the phone lines. If you have any questions for Timo, 201-209-9368, 201-209-9368. You could also go to the WFMU.org playlist and comments board where people are out there chatting it up. They're asking some questions on the comments board. I'm going to let them call in. And I want to know about a day in the life of the ranch, but maybe we should get back to, you know, some of the technologies that you use. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm posting links to workshops that the ranch hosts. And so maybe talk a little bit about permaculture design, and then we'll go into a day in the life at the ranch.
Okay, yeah, permaculture design certification courses are one of the offerings that we have on our calendar. Permaculture is a philosophy that is becoming increasingly popular. It was popularized in the early 1970s, so still a relatively young idea, but seems to be attracting a lot of interest as people become increasingly interested in the environment and sustainability. So essentially it's a set of ethics and principles and methodologies that can be learned in a two-week class. And essentially it teaches people how to read the landscape, how to essentially look at your land for those interested in designing it in the most ecological way possible, but with kind of a human-centric lens to it. And so the idea with permaculture is to create harmonious spaces that provide, you know, habitat for all life, but that also are able to, you know, provide the basic needs of humans. So for those interested to learn more, they can poke around on the internet for permaculture design certification classes. And it's a really transformational, empowering way for people to kind of reset the way that they look at the world.
And maybe talk a bit now about when a course is in place, like, for example, a permaculture design workshop. Who comes there, and what is a day in the life like for people taking a course?
Yes, so the course participants come from all over the world. It's not uncommon for us to have 10 or more nationalities represented at a permaculture design certification class. It's a very intensive course. It's basically 50-50 between practical and theory. So these students essentially are delving deep into some of what we already talked about. You know, natural building is a piece of permaculture, so we'll actually get into the mud. We'll mix sand, straw, and clay together to make adobe bricks or to apply it onto a latticework of bamboo in the case of Wadalandab. They learn about essentially manipulating the land in a way that prevents erosion, that keeps the ground covered, that builds fertility. And so they are basically hands-in learning a lot of the different techniques that we are putting into practice there to be able to grow more food, to build our buildings in the most ecological way possible, to process the harvests in a way that allow us to maximize nutrition and efficiency. And then there's the theory part. So, you know, we get up early at the ranch, and in the PDCs, which is short for Permaculture Design Certification class, yeah, we're spending equal time between the classroom learning about these theories and then, you know, getting our hands and feet into these practices that, you know, permaculture promotes and espouses, gets people back to the earth. And there seems to be an increasing interest and movement for people that are looking for ways to engage not only their brains but their bodies and activities that contribute to the betterment of the world and to, you know, these techniques that hopefully are allowing us to reconnect ourselves with shelter, to reconnect ourselves with food production, to reconnect ourselves with face-to-face communication, and on down the line.
So I'm going to open up the phones, 201-209-9368. We might start a conversation, Timo, and then we might get interrupted by a phone call. And if, in that case, I'll just say, let's stop for a minute, and then we'll go back to that topic. 201-209-9368, if you have any questions for Timo, now would be a good time to call, 201-209-9368. Maybe we'll move on to one of my favorite topics that I've learned about at the ranch and the hands-on experience of timber framing and what that means, how it's different than maybe stick framing or other forms of carpentry, and what's the sort of how's the environmental impact differently, et cetera. So you want to talk a little bit about timber framing? And I did post a link to workshops at the playlist and comments board.
Yeah, so timber frame construction is another one of our focuses. It's essentially taking, we have a lot of timber resources in Costa Rica. We're using local sustainably harvest trees to essentially build the frames for a lot of the structures that we use and live in. So taking, you know, large timbers anywhere from 5 by 5, 5 inches by 5 inches and larger, and essentially putting them together using an age-old technique called mortise and tenon joinery. So essentially joining these timbers together without the use of any metal fasteners. This is a technique that's thousands of years old that is being used in Asia and Europe and increasingly throughout the U.S. It became popularized in the northeastern part of the U.S., New York and Vermont, and is spreading. So this is a technique that allows us to use the abundant timber resources in a sustainable way. The infill, the wall systems being made from the wattle and daub, as I mentioned, so this kind of hybrid combination of timber frame construction and wattle and daub wall panels or infills, it has kind of been the go-to for us to build with these appropriate technologies in a way that honors these incredible traditions that have been around for so long that are, you know, proving to be a lot less impactful on the environment than, say, compared to a stick frame house, a conventional house that might be built in a residential neighborhood these days.
So when I first started coming to the ranch, you would have folks come down and teach timber framing. You would have folks come down and teach natural building. You would hire sort of professors, for lack of a better term, instructors. And now you're doing all of that in-house. How did that change come to be over the years? And if you want to make a phone call, if you want to talk to Timo, 201-209-9368. Call in anytime over the next 15 minutes. Go for it, Timo.
Yeah, so in the beginning when we were, really newbies at a lot of what it is that we were trying to bring into the fold of the ranch's educational offerings, we invited professionals, experts in a lot of these areas to come and teach at our site. And during those times, we were providing food and lodging for these students while essentially being students ourselves, learning about the different techniques that were being taught by these experts who were coming in. And after 20-some years of learning about these practices and putting them into practice ourselves, we were able to essentially become the teachers. It doesn't mean we still don't invite other teachers to come and teach about certain techniques that we want to add to our repertoire, but we have been able to more and more be the teachers in a lot of these topics, which from a financial standpoint has been positive for us, you know, living out on the edge of the rainforest in a rural...
Oop, hold on, there. Hold on, yeah. Yeah, we had a call and we lost it. Sorry.
No
sorry about that. Don't hang up no matter what. Oh, they're trying again. Let's take this phone call. Hi, who are we speaking to?
Sparky.
Hey, I know this guy. Hey, you know a guy named Sparky, Timo?
Hey, Sparky.
Hey, Timo, how's it going, buddy?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Sparky has a history. He has a history at the ranch. We've known each other for a while. Yeah, go ahead, Spark. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, I met Al in 2005 at the ranch, and Timo, and a ton of other people, and that's kind of what I wanted to touch on. And just, I know there's been a ton of incredible talent that's come through the doors just on a volunteer basis or as students. Wondering if you could just talk a little bit about some of the people that have come through and gone on to do some incredible projects.
Yeah, I think I need the rest of the show and another few shows
Thanks,
to talk about this and give it justice. But yeah, we've had, as you might imagine, thousands of people come through the ranch over the last couple of decades, many whom have gone on to just do absolutely incredible work, including Sparky and so many others. The ranch, I think, not only is a place that teaches people about the skills that we've been talking about, but inspires people that do come through to go out and start their own initiatives in the world that are hopefully positively contributing to their communities in a wide variety of ways. And so, it's just been unbelievable to see what these people have gone on to do, the social piece at the ranch, the networking, the friendships that are created is a part that we haven't touched on, but is such an important part of what we do at the ranch, and oftentimes what just naturally unfolds. You bring people together in a space like the ranch without the ability to look at your screen much, because the internet's either non-existent or so slow. It really does foster these face-to-face conversations, which is a big part of the ranch. Essentially, you're constantly interacting with incredible people and engaging in conversations that oftentimes can be totally life-changing and set people on a different path than perhaps the one that they were on, and encourage and inspire and motivate people to live their life a little bit differently, thinking more about how they can be a positive impact in the environment and in their society.
Speaking of that, sort of socializing at the ranch and bringing people together, meals are a hugely important part of just life at the ranch. Food, how important it is, how you bring it together, where you get it from, and what are meals like?
Yeah, meals are 100%. Communal, as I talked about before, essentially we're sourcing all of our calories from local farmers. It's been a big part of our philosophy, is to support local agriculture. So we are able to source almost all of our calories from local farms and or from the ranch itself. And then those meals are cooked, processed in our processing kitchen, and then cooked and then served buffet style in a communal setting. So we all eat all of our meals together all of the time. And that's oftentimes where the magic happens. The conversations at the ranch, the meal times really are loud, full of conversation and people getting to know one another and having these amazing conversations about topics that I really find meaningful and important. And I think this
idea of
eating together really is something that we've moved away from a lot, at least in the U.S. where I grew up. And, that is oftentimes an extremely important place for people to be able to interact and learn and teach, and when you take that away, it can be extremely detrimental to family structure, society, and so, having these communal meals really is an important component of the experience at the ranch.
Timo, we have somebody on the line. Who are we speaking to?
Hey, this is Zachary.
Hey, Zach, how's it going? You have a question for Timo?
Hey, doing well. No, great show. Appreciate the interview, all the information. Sounds like an amazing place. Got a family here, young family out in the Midwest, interested in these types of projects. Anything you'd recommend that we could get into moving into, I guess it's going to be fall here soon and then winter?
If it's something that you've been dabbling in or not, I feel like a couple of activities that can kind of be gateway activities into some of the practices that we teach and assess there are, fermentation. And if you don't do any gardening yet, if you have a space to do that, just growing a little bit of food, even if it's herbs on the windowsill or some tomatoes out on the side of the yard. But I feel like those two activities for families can really open up the door and kind of pave the way for going deeper into a lot of these activities. You know, making sauerkraut is something that I continue to do all the time. When I come back here to the States to visit family, I'll get a big batch of sauerkraut going, go down to the farmer's market or wherever you can get some good cabbage, and very easily with some salt and water and a bit of thyme, you know, produce as many gallons of sauerkraut that you want, and then, you know, eat it over the next couple of months. And, you know, just having your hand in the magic that is fermentation really can be empowering. Making your own dairy kefir, making your own yogurt, activities that really are very easy and can be, you know, done with the whole family, getting everybody involved, breaking some ground in your backyard and planting a small garden again, you know, being physically active, getting your hands in the dirt, releasing some of those beneficial hormones that allow us to feel balanced and make us feel happy, really can be, yeah, an amazing antidote. You know, a lot of the show's about tech and you know, how it can detrimentally affect us as a person, and, you know, just creating these practices that you're able to engage in every day that remove you from the indoors, that take you away from your screen and get you active, really can be the beginning of, you know, restructuring your life to one that feels better, more balanced, and more meaningful.
Thanks, Timo. Thanks, Zach. I'm going to make room.
Yeah, thank you.
Make room for possibly one more call, but we're running out of time. We have about 8 minutes, Timo, and then we got to give it up for It's Complicated with Dave Mandel. But I posted links to your bamboo construction workshop and wilderness first responder workshops. I think what we should do is talk a little bit about, if people want to visit the ranch, the best way, I say, is take one of these courses that are up there and learn something. And I think something that's important to say, that it's not a hotel. There's hospitality, but you're not going to have great internet. You're not going to have people waiting on you hand and foot. It's a work environment where people are working to get through the day. You're going to meet at certain times for meals. You can enjoy this incredible community and ecosystem, but don't expect to go there and be treated like you would at the Sheraton. You're going to become a part of a community. But if people want to visit the ranch, either through a workshop or just a visit, what would you say?
Yeah, you know, we've got a great website. That's the main place where you can learn about what it is that we do. We do post to social media. We're quite active in that realm. It is one of the ways, as a rural entity, that we're able to get the word out, as a place that depends on people finding out about us and where we are and how to get there. These are some of the technologies that we are able to use to be able to promote a project that would otherwise be, you know, almost impossible to pull off. So, yeah, our website is at Rancho Mas Total. You can see the links there, as Al said, and yeah, find us on the standard social media. You can, you know, contact us via WhatsApp or by sending us an email.
You can find everything you need at www.ranchomastatal, which I have posted a few times to the playlist and comments board, along with links to all of the upcoming workshops. So why don't you quickly wrap up maybe with you take your pick, bamboo construction or wilderness first responder workshops that can be taken at the ranch?
Yeah, let's see. I guess wilderness first responder certification class, it's one that I think some people are surprised to hear that we include in our suite of offerings. You don't oftentimes think about wilderness medicine when you hear the word sustainability, but as a community, as a place that lives in an extremely rural area, it's very important for us to be able to take care of ourselves out there, as well as being able to take care of our neighbors. So we've kind of been the default medical clinic in town for many years and kind of trying to bring that skill set into town. So if somebody does get a severe cut with a machete or doesn't get to the hospital in time to have their baby or is experiencing any number of ailments or health issues or injuries, it's incredibly important for a place like Masvidal to have people in town that are able to address these issues. So through an organization called Area Backcountry Medicine, we've been hosting wilderness medicine classes since 2003, I believe. We offer a wilderness medicine semester for those that are interested in getting their EMT certification, and then the main course that we offer annually is our wilderness first responder certification class, which is a 72-hour training. It goes, you know, well beyond the first aid training that many people might be aware of and familiar with, and kind of delves deeper into a lot of the life-threatening and non-life-threatening issues that we commonly face in the rural setting where we are.
Thanks, Timo. So we're going to start making way for It's Complicated with Dave Mandel. I just want to thank one more time Tim O'Hara of Rancho Masvidal. Gave up a day of soccer with his daughter for this, and I very much appreciate it, Timo. I hope it was fun for you as much as it is for me. It was a pleasure for me to bring what I consider two of the most important resources in the world together for much, much different reasons, WFMU and Rancho Masvidal, and to bridge that gap. So thank you. I'm going to end with a few minutes of Timo and family are deadheads, so I'm going to end a little bit with a little bit of Grateful Dead. And once again, all of the links are at the playlist and comments board. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And Timo, I'll catch up with you later, all right?
All right. Thanks so much. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Thanks, man. You're listening to WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org.
We can share what we got of yours, cause we done shared all of mine. Keep on rolling, just a mile to go. Keep on rolling, my old buddy, you're moving much too slow.
And as Bill Bruford skulks away, we begin another episode of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I come to you, it comes to you, this show comes to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m. I am your host, Dave Mandel. Thrilled, always thrilled to be here playing music for you. Thanks for joining me tonight. The usual hour of extreme fun and excitement in store for you here today. And we're going to start with a group called Cressida. This was a UK-based band, England, active in the very early 70s, like 1969, 1970, right on the cusp of the 70s. And I mention that, well, first of all, because I'm obsessed with dates, but more importantly, I mention it because this is very early, very precocious, you might say, right? We're going to hear a track from an album. This band broke up, I believe, in late 1970. This album came out, I think, shortly after the band actually broke up, give or take a few weeks. So it's a 1971 release on the Vertigo label, I might add, which was, of course, one of the great 70s prog and otherwise labels, Vertigo. So Cressida, we're going to hear a track from... They put out two albums, and we're going to hear a track from the second one, which is called Asylum. As I said, released in 1971, and that is about it. Cressida, here you go.
Make a start. Get up and say, forget the space, they're no concern of mine. I know it has your friends in there, but they don't mind. Leave them behind. You need a place to stay. I'm sorry, dear, you can't stay. They're not fretting over you, so don't lose sleep for them. And with one good one, start again. We'll be right back.
And that's music from the group Cressida, as in Troilus and Cressida, and a track called Lisa from the second of two albums they released, which was called Asylum, released on the Vertigo label in 1971. And when I said, maybe I was not clear, when I said that I thought they were precocious or ahead of their time or whatever the heck I said, what I meant was that they're quite proggy very early on. It's kind of hard to believe that that's recorded. I believe that record was recorded in 1970, and I hear some ELP, a little bit of King Crimson, pretty early on, and so I would call them pioneers. Why not? All right, we're going to hear next from somebody who is borderline. I try not to be too borderline, but close enough. We're going to hear something from David Bedford. David Bedford's not generally considered a prog artist. He's not really even considered a rock artist, I guess, most of the time. He's more contemporary classical kind of guy, but he hung with a lot of prog people, well, not just